You're listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. Thousands of panels of the 35-year-old AIDS Memorial Quilt were recently displayed in San Francisco. We look at the future of this monument to loss and to hope.
There will be panel making workshops all over the South, but we'll be talking about HIV at the intersections of faith. We'll talk about HIV and public health. We'll call names. We'll celebrate and celebrate arts and culture in those communities.
We want to see a day when there's no more quilt being made, where we have the last one. There's a panel that's been made that hangs in the quilt warehouse that says the last one.
I'm Mel Baker, and this is Civic.
Good morning. I'm Mike Smith. I'm one of the co-founders of the AIDS Memorial Quilt. On behalf of Cleve Jones and Gert McMullen, the other two co-founders, I welcome you all to this 35th anniversary display of the AIDS Memorial Quilt. This is the largest outdoor display in more than a decade and the largest display ever in San Francisco.
On this edition of Civic, we look at some of the history of the AIDS Memorial Quilt and how activists in the 21st century hope to use it again to change the world.
35 years ago yesterday, Cleve and I hosted the first volunteer meeting for the quilt. Six people came, including Gert, who brought two panels she'd already made. Our mission was to take an idea and make it a reality. We were going to drag our dead to Washington and lay them out on America's front yard until attention would be paid. We succeeded that fall when nearly 2,000 quilt panels were laid out on the Mall. What we never expected was that nearly half of those panels came from mothers from every state. Mothers too afraid to tell their church groups what their sons had died of. Mothers so alone in their grief and desperate for connections that they sewed beautiful quilt panels for their dead sons and then mailed them off to a bunch of gay men in San Francisco they didn't even know. How desperate. We thought we would change the world that day on October 11th, 1987, and in some ways we did.
When the quilt was first displayed on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. in 1987, it was a grim time. Researchers had recently determined that nearly everyone infected with HIV would develop AIDS and die. At that time, there were over 50,000 cases of AIDS reported in the U.S., along with nearly 41,000 dead. That was Reagan White House Press Secretary Larry Speaks openly mocking a question by reporter Lester Kinsolving in 1982, the first in a series of similar press conferences from the White House. By the time more than 4,500 had died in 1985, it was still a big joke to the White House and to many of the elite journalists who made up the White House press corps. The administration continued to resist efforts to fully fund research and public education programs into the AIDS crisis throughout the very end of Reagan's time in office. While speaking at the 35th anniversary of the AIDS quilt, Names Project founder Cleve Jones remembered the rage he and others felt at the time.
When we started this, I want to be very clear. My heart was full of anger and hate, fear and despair. All my friends were dying. The government did nothing. Our churches kicked us out. Our families abandoned us. It seemed that the world was totally unwilling to look at what was going to happen. And the one nation on earth that had the power and the resources and the institutions and the knowledge to stop this failed. Failed utterly because it was a gay disease. And then when we found out other people were dying, they were black. And this combination of homophobia and racism prevented us from moving the world forward to confront the crisis. And now 35 years later, we got 40 million dead and 40 million more living with the disease and still no cure and still no vaccine. And we've heard speakers talk of the lessons we learned. Did we learn them? I don't think we did, because I think for the last 2.5 years, we've been repeating the same mistakes, seeing the same tragic flaws, seeing once again the unscientific, bigoted appeals to stigma. A China virus? Please. So I don't know what we learned, but when we started this, Gert and I were furious, and we are still furious. But I also want you to know that in my heart, thanks to this quilt, all that hate and fear and despair has been replaced. And for me, this quilt is the physical embodiment of love and courage and hope. The movement saved my life. When I was a frightened queer kid in Phoenix, Arizona in the 1970s getting ready to kill myself, I read about gay liberation and I got the hell out of Phoenix and I came to San Francisco. And then when I was dying of AIDS, ACT UP, stormed the NIH, confronted the FDA, and got the medications released that saved my life. So when I tell you the movement saved my life, that's not rhetoric, it's not hyperbole, it's the truth. It saved my life, it can save your life, it can save this country, and it can save this planet. Thank you for being part of this movement. I love you all very much. Now we will begin the reading of the names. This is a ritual that has been repeated thousands of times in every state in the United States and all across the world. James Bryson, Blaine Cunningham, Brad Hay, David Flores, Jim Poche.
The unfolding of the AIDS Memorial Quilt in Golden Gate Park's Robin Williams Meadow was the largest since one in Washington, D.C. in 2012. It included 3,000 of the 50,000 panels that now make up the quilt. The quilt returned to the Bay Area from Atlanta in 2020. The Names Project had moved it from San Francisco to Georgia in 2000. You can hear more about the return of the quilt to the Bay Area in our civic episode, Pandemic and Protest, from June of 2020.
Nick Guinta, Jack Castor, and my dear friend Marvin Feldman.
Those who manage the quilt have no intention of it becoming an historical artifact. Sections of the quilt will soon be on the road again.
Roger Lyon, Steve Newberger, Stephen J. Leonard, Paul Alsbach, Kendrick Brown, Scott Lago, Seth Miller, and Stephen Syme.
The quilt is now open. Quilt monitors, please take your positions. The public is welcome onto the quilt.
In a recent episode of Civic, while SF fought COVID, HIV prevention stalled, we learned how the focus on COVID over the last 2 years has led to a rise in new and untreated HIV infections in San Francisco.
The city had started out prior to the pandemic with a 75% virologic suppression rate, and it went down to 70%. And then the homeless, it went from a 39% virologic suppression rate, which was already really poor, down to 20%. So only 20% of our people living with HIV who are homeless in the city of San Francisco have achieved that goal of therapy of having virologic suppression. So the slippage was very obvious.
In parts of the southern U.S., the situation is far worse. We spoke with Dafina Ward, executive director of the Southern AIDS Coalition, during the display of the quilt in San Francisco. She said that HIV testing was below half of what it had been before the COVID pandemic.
We know that our workforce had to be redeployed to address COVID in many of our communities, and so we don't know. We know it's going to be significant. We know that it has likely set us back, but we can't say for sure. I can share that we recently did a survey in the South. We surveyed over 100 community-based organizations in the South that are serving sexual and gender minorities and folks living with HIV, and 96% of them reported that their service delivery was impacted by COVID.
The challenge goes beyond providing people with medical care.
And also, most of them reported that they were receiving requests for food and mental health support at the same rate. So what we also recognize that in addition to what it means as far as HIV is also all of these other intersecting issues that people are dealing with, and the fact that as a collective we have to address all of those issues to be very intentional and impactful as it relates to addressing the needs of people living with and impacted by HIV in the South. We're definitely going to have to de-silo HIV. These can't be conversations for just some of us. It has to include all of us. And in many southern states, people don't even have access to the pills, to the medication, because we still have waiting lists on our AIDS drug assistance program in southern states. And then you also don't have Medicaid expansion in many southern states. Our rural hospitals are closing. So there's just a number of challenges that really impede the ability for people to get access to the resources that they need, which is even more reason why it has to be all hands on deck. And wherever a person comes and knocks on a door for help, they should be able to get access to everything that they need. And that approach is called the no wrong door approach. And we've seen that in substance use and mental health services. And that's something that has to become, I think that has to be the standard and best practice for us in HIV as well.
Ward's organization, the Southern AIDS Coalition, will partner with the AIDS Memorial Grove that now manages the quilt to take it on the road for a tour of the southern U.S. in the fall of 2022.
So it'll be large displays in city centers, as well as smaller displays even in rural, you know, non-metro and rural communities as well. But even on top of that, in addition to the quilt being on display, there's going to be days of programming in each of the cities. So we'll be talking about HIV at the intersections of faith. We'll talk about HIV and public health in that community. We'll have storytelling. We'll call names. We'll celebrate and celebrate arts and culture in those communities. So it will be so much more than just a display, but a true immersion into understanding how communities can advocate and be a part of continuing these conversations and reducing stigma around HIV in those communities. It'll also be an opportunity to display quilts that feature members of the communities where we're touring. So you'll see quilts from people, you know, celebrating the lives of people from those specific cities, which I think will be truly impactful, and particularly Black and brown folks who we know are not as strongly represented in the quilt as we would like for them to be. There will be panel making workshops all over the South, and so we're very excited about that. I mean, we have a number of groups that are already on board and want to participate in that process. So people will be coming. We'll also be at different conferences in the South where there will be opportunities for people to make quilt and to celebrate the lives of people that they've loved. I think the grief is so layered for us right now that I'm hoping that this quilt tour is a space for healing. You know, we talk often about all of the different grief that we're carrying and all of this trauma that we're all carrying collectively and individually. And so I think the quilt can even hold a different type of significance for people as we're dealing with COVID and addressing HIV/AIDS related deaths and all the other things that we are really fighting through together. So I think it'll be a space for grieving, and I'm hoping it'll also be a space for healing as well.
One of the most powerful things someone can do when visiting a quilt display is to read some of the names of those who have died Organizers often invite the family, friends, and loved ones to read a group of names that include one of those they lost to AIDS.
Hi, my name is Michael Kerner. I'm here with Open House, and my partner and I are here together to read names. We're signed up for the 2:30 slot. So we signed up today to come here out of respect for those we lost. I was lucky enough to be part of the second generation of HIV diagnoses, and so I was beneficial of the medications that came out. So I stand on the shoulders of the people who went before me, so I'm grateful to be here. I lived in D.C. in the 90s when it was displayed at the National Mall, and my relationship with the quilt has been difficult. It was too overwhelming, and I didn't have any ways of coping with it. Being from a small town in the middle of nowhere, it was terrifying to me. And so it took a lot of time and a lot of work to be able to come to the quilt in any way that was healthy and in a way that meant something to me, because it was always too scary.
Why don't you start me off, honey?
Okay. First of all, would you mind just identifying yourself?
Sister Mary Peter, M-E-R-R-Y, because there's enough tired Marys running around the community. Somebody should be happy. You can figure out the Peter part on your own. And I've been a sister of perpetual indulgence for 38 years. And I am here today to read the names of our nuns of the above. Our panel is out for many of our founders and sisters who've passed with HIV and AIDS, to remember all of them. I'm also here to offer support and to be a witness to the people coming through on this beautiful day. What's really powerful today is just there's deep grieving, but there's also deep connecting. And so many people are discovering lost parts of their family history. So many people are discovering stories of their ancestors they didn't know before. So many people are just meeting each other in a safe space where they can feel love and gratitude and inspiration from these panels that are like Instagram pages for days, filled with people's potential and exploration and joy and ecstasy. It's been really holy, just a really holy day. It started this morning, they just laid out the grids with the black tape. So you just had a sea of empty green swatches. And then as people unfolded each quilt, little pops of color started to fill the empty squares until the whole valley was filled with life. And then there was a moment where they say, and now the quilt is open and everyone floods in, and you just saw the memories and the lives today meeting each other.
The federal response to HIV and AIDS has changed dramatically since the mocking homophobic press conferences of the Reagan administration. Today, the Biden administration's AIDS response is led by a gay African-American man who is himself a long-term survivor of the virus. We caught up with Harold Phillips near the quilt.
As the director of the White House Office of National AIDS Policy, I am President Biden's senior advisor on HIV policy and programs. So really thinking about how the administration can move forward in a more equitable way to address the HIV epidemic in the United States.
So one thing that has come up here in San Francisco is that during the pandemic, we kind of backed off on our HIV care, both prevention and also for long-term survivors. Is that something that the administration's noticing around the country, and is there a policy plan to deal with that?
Yes, we've noticed it a lot. Some because our already strained public health system during COVID-19, we saw staff being deployed to address the immediacy of COVID-19, and so they stopped some of the HIV work. Also, we've seen decreases in the number of HIV tests conducted across the United States. We also saw people fall out of HIV care, some of our long-term survivors. And also with social distancing, a lot of services had to move to telehealth, which didn't necessarily work for everybody. And if you're in a rural area where you got poor internet service, that also didn't work too well either. So one of the things that President Biden has done is called for us to accelerate our HIV efforts. He released a new national HIV AIDS strategy on World AIDS Day of last year. And we're hoping to use National HIV Testing Day, June 27th, as an opportunity to refocus the conversation on HIV. both getting HIV tested, linked to care if you're positive, and linked to our prevention options, which we've got a number of them, including long-acting injectables and PrEP for those who are at risk, not HIV positive. So June 27th, we're hoping to refocus the conversation and our efforts around HIV. COVID's here for a while, so we're learning, I think, to live with it. And living with it means we got to also focus on HIV and other sexually transmitted infections.
Speaking of injectables, they're very, very expensive. And is there an administration policy to make sure that things like Medicare and to push states with their Medicaid programs to make sure they cover this, especially for people that have a difficulty maintaining a pill regimen?
A quick aside. Injectables are newly marketed HIV drugs that can be injected into a person's muscle tissue, which allows them to be slowly released into the bloodstream over a matter of weeks, thus eliminating the need for daily pills.
Absolutely. We're working with Medicaid, Medicare, as well as working with private insurance around covering the cost of the long-acting injectables and changing our policies. President Biden also, in the FY23 budget request, has called for a national PrEP program, especially for those uninsured and underinsured. And we would not only be covering the medications, including injectables, but also covering services for those that need to access PrEP, need to become more aware of PrEP, and also reminders, so patient navigators to help keep people on PrEP, transportation services for those who need help and assistance getting to the clinic. So I think, you know, July 7th, we acknowledged 10 years of having PrEP as an HIV prevention tool. And we're still working on what should the programs that help people really become aware of PrEP and maintain access to the medications, what should those look like? So the national PrEP program that's proposed by the president will hopefully help shape that for us.
What about programs for research and such? So, you know, we've just been a decade away from a cure for 3 decades.
Yeah.
Is there any extra money being put into research, especially stuff like CRISPR technology, those sorts of more advanced stuff that might cure long-term survivors, for instance?
Yes, the NIH is continues to do work on a cure and a vaccine. I think it's been at least documented and well known that our ability to find a COVID-19 vaccine is a result of the years and decades of HIV research toward a vaccine. So now that we've sort of got COVID-19 vaccines underway, our research scientists involved in vaccine research for HIV have also learned a lot from that sort of effort. And now they're turning their attention and refocusing on our efforts for an HIV vaccine and also a vaccine cure. Dr. Fauci presents and talks about this as well. And it's still hopeful that we can get there. We are learning so much. Our medications are much better than they were 40 years ago or even 35 years ago as we sort of commemorate the 35th anniversary of the quilt today. We've come so far, and they're continuing the work with a lot of the AIDS research that's going on as well. And there are additional investments from the federal government's part in that too.
One of the most difficult things to get is federal funding to help other countries with HIV care and prevention. And there was a major effort to do that in Africa and places like that. How has the Biden administration continued that? One thing that we noticed here on the panel is the quilt was opened up to the world, and a lot of the names are African names. Young children dying in Africa or people dying in Africa where the infection rate is spectacularly high. Is the administration able to maintain a reasonable level of funding for those programs?
Absolutely. President Biden has pledged his continued support for our PEPFAR program, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. By our First Lady, just about maybe a month ago, announced a historic investment in HIV care, treatment, and prevention for the country of Panama. Also, I'm very excited, our new global AIDS ambassador is going to start work, so really excited to have him on board that will also continue the work. And currently under PEPFAR, we've got 21 countries across the world, some in Africa, some in Asia, that have reached epidemic control. And that means that 90% of the people with diagnosed HIV in those countries are virally suppressed, meaning they can't pass it on to their sexual partners. So with 21 countries already around the world who've reached epidemic control, here at the United States, we're at 67%. So we've got a lot of work to do, but I think the lessons learned from some of those other countries is we can do it. It can be done. It's real. it's achievable, and I'm very hopeful that the United States will get there.
One of the major things is the majority of HIV patients are 50 years and older in the United States. Is there enough funding to make sure that people that didn't have enough resources to prepare for retirement or what have you are going to be able to get a little extra care?
So this is something that we're looking at. You know, our new national strategy talks about those who are over 50 as well as elderly living with HIV. I think we're still figuring out what that all means and what sort of services will individuals need that are different and how do we do that. And so it's going to take a whole of government effort to look at this. Luckily, the Administration for Community Living, which handles senior services in America, they are on board and have mandated that people living with HIV be included in state aging plans. So that's a first step to really look at and better understand what are the resources that are needed at the community level for people who are aging with HIV. We're also looking at quality of life for people living with HIV. And we know the definition of quality of life changes as one ages. So things like social isolation, housing status, employment status, physical abilities. Also, how do we measure all of that in addition to sort of clinical and medical well-being, which we've been doing for a while? So it's a point in the history of the epidemic in our country that I don't think we really thought about 40 years ago. I think we've got a lot of work to do, also including training our medical professionals on how to take care of people living with HIV who are over 50. Things like bone density, frailty assessments. So there's a huge amount of work to do. And services so that we can still be our authentic selves as we age and maybe go into a senior living facility. So I find it both fascinating, something to celebrate, living with HIV and reaching these milestones. And just like we've changed the healthcare system when we were early, the healthcare system for delivery, and we've changed research as people living with HIV and demanding our rights, we're going to change services for the elderly as well. I truly believe that. And some of this starts with community conversations about what are the different types of services and different providers that one needs as you age with HIV.
Why come out to see the AIDS Quilt? Why was that important to have a representative of the administration here?
The AIDS Quilt plays an important part in our history of HIV for this country. It is a symbol of both those that we have lost and loved, but it's also a symbol of hope. And it's got an incredible power to unite us and bring us together, to both hear the stories of those we've lost and to remember them. It's important because it also helps to break down stigma. And part of what President Biden has called for is that we address HIV stigma and HIV criminalization, which still exists in a number of states. So it was really important to be here to represent Washington, D.C., represent the Executive Office of the President, and also people living with HIV.
The AIDS Memorial Quilt continues to influence federal and state policy by raising awareness and maintaining visibility for the ongoing need for research and improved treatment options. It even changes the perception of HIV around the world. Those charged with its care are determined that it has a permanent home in the place that gave it birth.
Kevin Herglotz, I'm the Chief Operating Officer at the National AIDS Memorial. Where we are in our long-term planning is looking at a center for health and social justice for us that would be located in San Francisco and would be a permanent home for the quilt. We're in early stages of that in terms of exploring the possibility and the opportunity to do that. We definitely feel it needs to be in San Francisco, and where that is, we don't know, but it's important. What we do and the work we do with this quilt has to be protected. It has to be conserved and preserved and made available to the public. So right now it's in a warehouse in San Leandro, but our hope is that it would be in a place we could either create a center that talks about these issues, that brings communities together. That's just not the story of the AIDS pandemic, but it's the story of justice, of health and social justice, and one that looks at pandemics. Because the lessons of the AIDS pandemic were not learned 40 years later, because we had a COVID pandemic and we've repeated as a nation and the world, quite frankly, the same mistakes, the stigma, the otherism, the disproportionate impact on communities of color. So this is a powerful teaching tool to hopefully reach you know, young and old, future generations, to hopefully we can, one, find a cure, but learn about the health and social justice and the racism and the bigotry that happens. And this quilt can be an important tool in helping cross that bridge. We're going to launch this program in the South, and then we'll be doing it in other communities. We have a community display program of the quilt. So the quilt goes out to hundreds of communities every year, displays, you know, 5-10 quilt blocks at a time at community events, LGBTQ centers, hospitals. We'll have them on display, universities and colleges. So we still are going to continue that program and bolster it. So we have messaging that goes with the quilt when it's going out to any community, and also providing a lot of that digitally as well. So it's easier to connect to the younger folks. You know, we don't want to keep making quilts. We want to honor those who have died, but it shouldn't be happening. We want to see a day when there's no more quilt being made, where we have the last one. There's a panel that's been made that hangs in the quilt warehouse that says the last one. We want to put that one in the quilt when it's the last one.
The hoped-for ending of this monument to suffering and hope is perhaps best summed up with Holly Near's song, I Am Willing, sung by the San Francisco Glide Church Ensemble, which opened the quilt ceremonies. I'm Mel Baker, and you've been listening to Civic. Civic is produced by KSFP-LP, a project of the San Francisco Public Press. Our team includes producer Liana Wilcox and contributor Sylvie Sturm. Jessica Prado is our photojournalist. She took part in the reporting of this episode. Lila LaHood is the publisher of the Public Press. Michael Stoll is our executive director. Our theme music is by John Dillon. Thanks for listening.